Blog Talk Radio. Good afternoon. This is Gail Sylvia, your host of SylviaGlobal.com. I'm so excited today to have a conversation with a new friend, Jody Evans. Jody Evans is one of the co-founders of Code Pink, and she has been a peace, environmental, women's right, and social justice activist and fundraiser for 40 years. She has traveled extensively to war zones, including Afghanistan, Gaza, and Iraq, promoting and learning about peaceful resolutions to conflict. She served in the first administration of Governor Jerry Brown and ran his presidential campaigns. She has published two books, Stop the Next War Now and Twilight of Empower, and has produced several documentary films, including the Oscar and Emmy-nominated The Most Dangerous Man in America and Howard Zinn's The People's Street. Jody, are you with me today?
Yes, I am. Thank you so much for having me.
I appreciate you being here. I know some additional insight is that you're the board chair of the Women's Media Center and that you sit on quite a few boards, including the Hereditary Disease Foundation, Rainforest Action Network, Institute for Policy Studies, and Sisterhood is Global Institute. So thank you for being here, Jody. Appreciate it. Can you talk to us about what happened in your life experiences that caused you to become an activist?
Well, I think the first thing that I did that really woke me up to my voice and that one person can make a difference and to engage happened when I was a maid in Las Vegas at one of the big hotels, and we got organized to march for a living wage. I think I was making something like $1.87 an hour. And many of the women I worked with were mothers and had kids, and they were single moms. So also, you know, walking with them and seeing that it would radically change their lives to make a living wage. And so we marched down the strip, and Jane Fonda came to march with us, and we won. And to this day, maids get a living wage at the major hotels in Las Vegas.
Define living wage.
Well, you know, it's not really a living wage, but when you say living wage in America, it's a very low number. But a living wage in Las Vegas for a maid, a starting salary is $20 an hour.
So it's above minimum. Above the minimum wage.
Yes.
But it's still low compared to where it could potentially be.
Yeah, and the difference, you know, in Las Vegas, so 25 miles away from Las Vegas are other towns that have gambling and big hotels, and they don't have unions or maids don't get a living wage, and those maids make minimum wage, which is less than half of what the maids make in Vegas.
So is a living wage and the reason for that protest during that time to set up a union for the maids?
Yes.
Okay.
So that they, and many times, you know, new hotels have come in, like when the MGM came in or the Paris. And one of the maids that marched, her husband died, and she left her with 11 kids, and she raised 11 kids on a maid salary. And then she became head of the union, and she led a six-year strike against the Frontier Hotel and broke it. And so, you know, whenever we win something, it takes constant vigilance to keep it. And because power and greed is always kind of, biting at our heels. So it's really been also very much women-led in Las Vegas, the union movement. It's one of the biggest union cities in the country.
How old were you when you joined that movement, and did you know Jane Fonda prior to that?
No, I was 16 years old, and it was in 1970, and I didn't know her, and I think it, you know, having her come march with us to care about our needs was very important to me as a girl.
It's amazing, isn't it, how powerful our presence can be and how we can make a difference, whether we're a single mom and a maid, raising 11 children fighting for a cause, or were someone in the limelight who has that can draw attention to a cause in the capacity of someone as Jane Fonda, the bottom line is showing up and being present to take action.
Well, yeah, Hattie Canty, the woman that I told you about that ran the union, I mean, what I know about that strike is it would have never happened if a woman wasn't at the head of it. And she had a best friend who, the two of them, they would sit outside the hotel, and she would come, and she would love up everybody that was, you know, protesting outside, picketing. And can you imagine for 6 years to picket outside of a hotel and hold together a union and people who had jobs, and, you know, at Christmas she would have all the toy stores give toys and she had people feed them. I mean, she was feeding families for 6 years, and they were picketing instead of having a job to, you know, stand up against this power that was going to deny the workers a fair wage. And, you know, for me, it's just like that patience, that commitment, that dedication, as Hattie said, it really comes, you know, we know it as a mother. We know, she said, when somebody said, how could you do that? She said, I'm a mom. You know, it's like, it's what it takes to, you know, get up every morning, day after day after day, or when your kid's sick, or, you know, whatever it is we take on as a parent. So it really has been women's leadership that has kept the hotels in Vegas honest. And they haven't suffered for it. You know, they're still making money hand over fist. But it's, you know, we don't think enough about how the things that we do naturally, how do we then use them in changing the world, in coming up against power and greed and corruption. And a lot of times what I see is that it closes us down. You have that feeling of disempowerment, like, it's bigger than me. I can't even think about it. It's ungraspable. And so it just really shuts you down. And I think it was, it was being in the streets with those maids that were, like, so small compared to these big, powerful hotels, but they could transform their behavior. And Hattie could transform the behavior of all the hotels in Vegas because she was able to take down the Frontier. No hotel could even think about not being union.
Like Rosa Parks and so many others around the world, one individual, you know, stepping up and finding her voice out of necessity, and in Rosa Parks' case, just sheer exhaustion and frustration, you know, that I'm not moving. And for Hattie and the others, you know, a single mom with 11 children, it's like, you know, something's got to be done. How do you encourage women around the world who are tired and they've been fighting the fight for a long time and they're not seeing the results yet? What words can you share with, you know, them, Jody, to encourage them to not lose hope and to remain faithful and not discouraged?
Well, I have two answers for that. One, I just came back from AWID in Istanbul, which was 2,000 women from 90 countries working together. And the heartbreaking piece for me was that I did spend a lot of time with the women from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they're beyond tired. You know, they are exhausted. They have trashed themselves for, you know, 10 years. They've been working for something. And not only is it gone backwards, but they have no hope. They have absolutely no hope. And I really came back with a very heavy heart about that. And, you know, like, and so often when I travel the world and I say, what do you need from the women in the United States? And what do the women tell me is they need the women of the United States to use their power. And I don't, you know, when I say that, when I come back, it really is a mirror for the women here to recognize how powerless they feel. But compared to the women of the world that struggle so hard, they have more power than those women will ever know, but we don't use it. They're, you know, I don't have to say to these women, you know, have hope, because their hope is driven from love and desire and a desire for beauty and joy and love. And and that desire is still there, but our behavior here affects them, and they're where they are starting to realize there's nothing they can do about it. And that's heartbreaking for me, because when we live in a country where our habits and behaviors are really being carried in the bodies and hearts of women around the world, what I hope it will do is help to change the behavior of more women in the United States.
You know, usually I ask this question at the end of the conversation, but I think I need to ask it right here. We're not going to end the conversation, though. So what behavior do we need to change that demonstrates support for women in Afghanistan, Iraq, and others around the world who have lost or are losing hope?
Well, one thing is that, you know, around when Bush was sending us to war, that women more than men were for the war. And I think it has to do with our desire for security and not understanding that security doesn't come from war and violence. It comes from care and support. And even the military knows that. The military teaches in its schools, and it says out loud that there is no military solution to Afghanistan. And yet, our Congress, all it spends money on is war. And, you know, it's that disempowerment piece. It's the piece where women in the West aren't using their power to stop what's happening to women in the world. I mean, we do it with our consumerism. We do it by thinking that war is going to make the world safer. I mean, there's so many behaviors. We do it, we think we dealt with slavery, but there are more slaves in the world than ever because of our consumer habits. I think it's about being conscious of what is this behavior I'm doing effective. You can't change the world, but you can change what's around you. And when you start living in a more conscious way, more aware of your choices, it'll make you behave differently where you are.
Were you raised to think this way?
No, I was not raised to think this way. Matter of fact, I have two very fearful conservative parents. So I think maybe watching and not really liking the behavior that came out of their fear and their conservatism. My father is a horrible bigot, and we used to fight at the dinner table nonstop. We only know how to fight. He claims to be a Christian, but has no compassion for most of the world, and he was for the death penalty. So I was, as a young girl, just quite confused by from a very simple place of thinking, how does one reconcile, you know, what he's saying? And I think having those thoughts has made me, you know, look at the world and see it in a way more holistically. You know, more, you know, that behavior causes this.
So I'm curious, you know, a lot of bigotry comes out of the church and out of religious beliefs that are misinterpretations of the original purpose and founding. And so in the case of Christians, the Bible has been used to start many wars and to justify bad behaviors. How did that affect your own faith and your ability to have faith as you've addressed such global, major issues in war-torn environments?
Well, I mean, also my mother's a Mormon, so I looked at both those experiences of religion and couldn't find anything there for myself. But I think what it did is it threw me back on myself, and what I found was my spirituality.
Yeah.
Rooted in maybe rooted from the place of the teachings that I got when I was very young, that I might have really connected to the teachings of, you know, love one another as you would love yourself. You know, it's like that, that kind of these, those very core teachings, I think, are inside of me. But they're not a religion. They're
right.
a way of being in the world. I think love, acceptance, forgiveness, you know, all of those things are in me, but I don't have a religion. I saw that my parents' religion for them was a way that they didn't have to deal with the mystery of what it is to be alive, that they needed rules and some form of discipline to make them feel safe. And so that, I think, you know, that, that need to make you feel safe is the shadow of that, is the violence that then you perpetrate on others. And what's obvious to those looking at it is that there's nothing that's happening that's rooted in the teachings. And I think that, you know, you look at all religions, and the core of all religions is the same teaching. It's that we are all one. There is only one thing, and it is, you know, it is God, and it's you, and it's everything. It's this oneness. But religion, in too often separates. It does the thing, the opposite of what spirituality is meant to do, which is to unite.
Do you move and make your decisions then, and have your passion for this incredible work on behalf of women and girls around the world? Are you doing this then from a place of love and the belief that this is your small contribution to big problems, or from the belief, or both, the belief that love can genuinely be the answer and we can see results soon if we just stay committed to the cause of love and uniting around love?
I don't think that way. What I do doesn't really go through my head. So I think I am a spiritual being that is as complex as everybody else. And what seems to motivate me is a desire to give and receive, which I guess in experience is love. So to be related, to have direct experience, to explore this mystery together. And I think that, you know, I'm very much motivated by injustice, that as a child I was very abused, so I think, and I think I have a habit, you know, that came out of that, of showing up for those that don't have voice, or an underdog, or those that don't have a seat at the table. I don't think about it. I think it's just like a must, you know, it's just like what comes out of me. Very much motivated by injustice and the desire that all beings be free. I think love is an experience that we share in that space of connection and experience and relationship and recognizing each as the other. But I think my desire for all beings to be free and to end injustice is more the motivating factor. I think the result is that it leaves me very full of love and joy and beauty.
How do you avoid, or are you able to avoid, internalizing those who misunderstand, misinterpret, and promote the, you know, they misunderstand the work and the motivation behind Code Pink. And I'm referring, for example, to Glenn Beck and others. You get a lot of national media coverage over the years, and one of the frustrations with when people have the mic and they're not giving equal share to both sides of the experience, and so they can, you know, leave the public with the impression that's not quite an accurate impression. What do you do with that?
Well, I think, you know, Glenn Beck is easy to just, you know, brush off. But I think, you know, there are other people that don't understand that you maybe are more progressive, and they may not like our tactics, or they want us to kind of not say the things we say because they're extreme. You know, here's the thing: is I don't operate of whether somebody approves of me or disapproves of me. That's not, I don't really care. I operate from a place of truth and justice, and that's the place I trust. And so, you know, when Colin Powell went to the UN and said there are weapons of mass destruction, I knew he was lying. And I don't know I'm just a person, but it was so vividly clear to me he was lying, in the same way as I could see my parents' religions were violent abuses of power. There, yet again, there was a violent abuse of power. If there were weapons of mass destruction, we would have never invaded. I mean, it was like crazy common sense. But I was in Iraq and pushed, a bunch of us were in Iraq and we were pushing reporters off their little stands as they were saying to the world, you know, we just heard from Colin Powell and he says there's weapons of mass destruction, and saying the world doesn't want war. Now, you know, that freaks people out, but it's an extreme thing when you are witnessing that the United States of America is about to invade an innocent country with weaponry, a country that had no weapons. Not only did they not have weapons of mass destruction, they had no weapons. So when you're about to witness that, yes, I do extreme things and they make people very uncomfortable, but I'm doing them from a place of wake up. You know, everybody's asleep. I mean, are you really going to let this happen? And, you know, Colin Powell's book came out this week, and he said that was the biggest mistake of his life. And he did it unconsciously. He put himself to sleep because he questioned the people that told him that at the CIA. He questioned them over and over again. So he was feeling, his voices inside of him knew it was wrong, but he put the responsibility on the person in the CIA and said, okay, you have to tell me this is right because you're going to be responsible, not me. I'll be the voice, but you're responsible because I'm listening to you and I'm delivering this information. And, you know, there was other information they wanted him to say and he refused, like Iraq was responsible for 9/11 and things like that. So he did refuse to say some, you know, things that would have really made him look stupid. But, you know, this is almost 10 years ago. So I knew one thing 10 years ago that now has cost this country $3 trillion, 5,000 innocent lives, 100,000 wounded soldiers, 5 million displaced Iraqis, and, you know, another 500,000 dead Iraqis. So I'm trying to just, you know, what do I do in moments of watching the insanity with which people that have power behave? Yes, I can look pretty outrageous, but I think what they are doing is so outrageous I can't even go to the place to mirror it.
Jody, you have used your voice at multiple levels, from, you know, running the presidential campaign for Governor Brown, to writing books, to creating films, hosting a radio show. How have you developed, how did you put yourself in those various arenas in order to expand the range and the turn up the volume on your voice and the message that you wanted to be heard in order to not let people sleep through life?
I think, you know, it's the same place I just described. It's the place of witnessing the injustice that pervades the world and wanting to be as effective as I can in the face of it. So I put myself in situations where I don't have a clue what I'm doing, so I can learn. And I'm willing to go to, new mind, new learning constantly. I'm always wanting to be more effective, wanting to understand the deeper meanings, wanting to try to figure out, like, why is power abusive? What happens when, you know, somebody who says one thing when they're running for office, gets into office and does the total opposite. You know, how do you, and then how do you address that? How do you wake them up? How do you change the behavior? How do you get inside the cogs of this machine and disrupt it so it stops? And I guess I have a very curious mind and a willingness to know nothing and throw myself into it and learn.
In your, you know, greatest imaginings and wildest dreams, what would you like, how would Code Pink be, like, effective beyond your wildest dreams? What would be the successes of Code Pink? And how would history record that 50 years from now?
Oh, in my wildest dreams from the day we started, what I saw, so we started when Bush was threatening to go to war on an innocent country, and he was calling Code Orange and Code Red and Code Yellow to make Americans frightened, and so we called Code Pink. And in my dream that night, it was hundreds and thousands and millions of women in dance and joy and love and the celebration, and there were pink tents all outside the White House, and we were disarming everyone and turning them away from their violent ways and reminding them of what it is to be in joy and in love and in relationship with each other and out of the kind of machine that is, you know, sucking life out of us. And it was my dream the night before, and the next day we did we started the vigil, and I described it to everyone. I said, we're going to have pink tents, and we're going to dance, and we're going to share and create and sing. And we get outside the White House. You're not allowed to sit down. You have to keep walking. No sign can be larger than, like, 2x4. And so my dream met the forces of denial, and you know, in a country where they say we have free speech, you don't, and where we supposedly live in a democracy, we don't. But we have been able to create those moments, and I hope we can continue to create those moments. And I think it's what's successful about Code Pink is that in the face of horror, in the face of war and loss and death and the violence of our country, you know, Mother's Day is coming up this weekend, and what we did on Mother's Day every year was we went outside the White House, and for 24 hours we got a permit, and we put up tents, and we dressed up, and a couple of years ago, for 4 months before Mother's Day, women knitted 5x5 green and pink squares, and they sent them all to Washington, and sitting, listening to women from war zones speak to us from the stage, and sitting on the grass, we sewed them all together, and by 24 hours later, we had a cozy, the entire length of the front of the White House, you know, like 50 feet long, and it read, "We will not raise our children to kill another mother's child."
Mm-hmm.
It's that. It's the same coming out of Women Occupy. You know, I went to all the Occupies, and I saw, just like in our culture, women's voices aren't being listened to. Women are being disempowered. They're being sent to, you know, do the kitchen while the men meet. And it was, you know, it's just a reflection of what happens in our society. And so the idea with Women Occupy was, like, how do we come together as occupiers, but then across the country and the world, and say, how do we empower ourselves? And it's, how do we be joyful? How do we find the leadership we can bring to this movement that isn't violence and pain, but that it's joy and love and celebration, and in those ways describe where we need to go. In Oakland, when they closed down the port, it turned to violence that night, and so Occupy was, you know, all about violence, and when it's that way, I realize, oh, less women will show up. And so we created a flash mob video of hundreds of people doing a flash mob, and it was all about this businessman walking through the flash mob, and this male, handsome male of color who's walking towards them, and they hold hands and then they hug. And so that flash mob was our answer to the violence that had happened around the port closure. So it's, you know, for me, it's like, how do you bring joy and beauty? Because I think it's when we turn away from the joy and beauty that we start to think that war is going to make us safer, or that we disconnect ourselves from the other. And so, you know, we have this new campaign with Eve Ensler and the Nobel Women, where the UN just said 1 billion women living have been raped. And so our goal for February 14-13 is that all the women in the world and the men and families that love them strike, leave the world that is the violent world, and go out into the street and dance together. And that would be like the fulfillment of my dream. If 1 billion women and men really did that, then you would know what the world could look like, and you would start making different choices. And so, you know, everybody, there's still an opportunity for that dream to come true.
Well, you're well on your way. Last question, and I hope you'll come back to sylviaglobal.com so we can have more conversation and expanded conversation on these topics. What do you do in your personal life? And I'm just asking these questions off the top of my head and from my heart as I listen to you. I wonder, what do you do, you know, Jody, in your personal life to refuel yourself and to maintain a spirit of joy and laughter and dancing when you're dealing on a day-to-day basis and you're so deeply committed to issues that are so traumatic and so ugly for most people to even look at?
Well, I think that it's not a doing. I think it's that I don't see what I do as work. I see it as just an extension of who I am. And this last weekend we had a convening. We pulled together an international conference on drones. And, you know, it's kind of like being at the beginning of the Iraq War. You're looking into the belly of the beast and trying to say to everyone, this is horrible. This is horrible. You have to think twice about this. You cannot do this. These, you know, the proliferation of drones is going to be a proliferation of unconscious violence on our world. And so, you know, the conferences, people who've been killed by drones, the U.S. not taking responsibility, nobody, 5,000 Pakistanis have been killed by these drones that are innocent. But no, we won't even own that it happened because it happens in the CIA. And then you hear the friend of the 16-year-old that Obama had killed with a drone, and you hear them cry, and you hear the people in Yemen talk about it, and the violence, you know, I'm in all of that. But what wholly inspires me every day are the people I work with. I mean, everyone in that room was giving their life to save another life, and that inspires me. I fall in love all day long, and it just inspires me and fills my heart and fills my life force. And so at the end of a 3-day conference about this thing that is so horrible, everyone was on fire with love and compassion and desire to make a difference. So I think it's a wave. I think, you know, the wave of pain and grief and horror and devastation and heartbreak, and letting that go through me and then moving into the joy and love, because once it does, it's like it moves you to that place of love, and then I just move into action. And I think for me, action is the way that I take what could close me down and move it through, because it's like, okay, I am doing the one thing I can do. And I know I can't change the world, but I can do one thing that'll make a difference in one life.
I love you, Jody Evans. I love the work that you do, and not because it's work, but because you see what needs to be done, and then you move according to what your heart calls you to do, and by taking those actions and those steps, are able to promote a spirit of joy and the strength that comes from that place, and also turning and taking and learning lessons from your own personal hardships in order to assure that others don't have to go through those experiences on mute, and that there can be a voice and a representation for them, and that all of us are able to do something to make a difference at every level, whether it's crocheting and being a part of the message, or it's the actual creation of the infrastructure that moves the change forward politically or at a very grassroots level. Thank you so much, Jody Evans from Code Pink, and I hope you'll join me again.
Thank you, Gail Sylvia. I love you.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day. And there were other questions I was going to talk to you about. You just have to come back.
Okay.